Hi everybody, welcome back to No Killing Goblins. This is going to be our third part to the end of Volume 8 series that we've been doing. Say hi, Dragonus.
Hey everybody.
It's been a little while for our recording and it's taken a bit of a climb. There have been struggles, but we're here to talk about the finale, to scream about it for an hour, as Dragonus described it to me.
Yeah, it seems like the only appropriate way to describe it, because it was a roller coaster.
Honestly, yeah. I mean, just watching it, okay. Full disclosure, I got to see some of it at the end be written, because Pirate asked for a little bit of feedback, because they did not stream any of the ending. Like, they didn't show anybody anything. They just, like, plopped it down and was like, here, eat, feast. So there was, like, a day where they asked for some feedback on it and all. Let me just tell you. Oh, boy. That was hard. It was hard to watch and not be able to talk about it, because, God, there was so much to scream about.
Yeah, no, the finale just kicked off. And it was weird, because it had sort of built up this Deadlands plotline going into it, right? Where we get to see Aaron sort of get introduced to all these crazy characters and pull out this really cool memory trick and turn the God's gifts against them. And, you know, for the most part, just chill and have good times. And, you know, learn things from ghosts with, you know, this sword hanging over everyone's metaphorical head of the gods. And then the weird, spooky, voidy one decided to just flip the table, summon 1,000,000,001 Cthulhus to devour them all, and it just fucking exploded. Because then apparently everybody else decided, well, fine, we'll one-up you, one Cthulhu, by summoning the Cthulhu that ate the God of Time. This is now the Cthulhu God of Time.
It was a little bit of, like, a shock moment. I mean, honestly, the entire Deadlands sequence had so many shock leak moments. It just, like, it was hard. And you could understand why Pirate sort of kept some of it away, but also why they developed it in the way they did. Because the reveal of Spriggana, the last elf, her son, the gnomes, the fact that the gnomes knew what the hell was going on, the fact that they clearly, all the immortals got together, have been planning this for the dead gods for a while now. Like, it's clear that they saw the end coming and they figured out a plan and they were executing it.
Oh, yeah.
Whatever that plan was.
Because, and that, like, the god of wizards decides to one-up the god of Cthulhu time-devouring with the system now works in the afterlife now. Have your levels back, motherfuckers.
Because, like, he fucking wrote a back door into the programming for the grand design. They named the grand design the system as the grand design.
Yeah, and we even got to find out some details about this big war between the gods and these other beings, which came down to, like, honestly, obviously we need to find out more, but it almost felt like you had a bunch of immortal, long-lived creatures getting pissy because it turned out that yet lesser mortals were going to get access to their nifty shit. Like,
oh, that was, I'm sure that was part of it. But the impression I always got from the gnomes was whatever last bit that they managed to stop the gods from implementing, because there's a direct mention that the grand design is incomplete. Whatever that was would have stolen something that even the so-called lesser mortals should have, what they truly believed should have. And the fact that the immortal beings are effective, like, dragons are immune to the system. They don't answer its call. They don't take levels. So clearly the choice is inherent to it. So you have to wonder what the fuck the gods were trying to do that was so aberrant that the other beings were like, no, you cannot do this.
Oh, yeah.
It was. Yeah.
More details are needed, but, like, what little we got from Spriggana and, like, her opinion and the question the gnomes asked Aaron about how she felt about levels in the grand design made me feel like what we see of the gods now is like the most wretched shadow on rice paper cast by a flickering lantern version of them. And I have to wonder if maybe at the time this war started out, it wasn't a more philosophically equally sided issue.
Yeah, the impression I got from the way Spirgaina talked about it as well. Oh, she's such a tragic figure. I could write a whole dissertation on just like I'm sure there's so much more depth to that. That's such a tragic story. And I absolutely do wonder if Pirate will at some point in the future go back to the past and write the story of the tragic fall of the immortal races and their war against the gods.
I
But
would read that prequel
what
book, Pirate.
I would
I'll set aside the
absolutely
money right now.
But in her experience with the other, like when we see her in the Deadlands, she absolutely refuses to fight them, even when it's evident that whatever aspect of the gods made them so admirable, so followable, so such beings that she admired and loved so much, and yet she rejected them and their choices, and then at the same time was like, I can't hurt you. And then there's the power. Okay, we could get into that later, but what I was trying to get with from Spirgaina is that she speaks to some of the people who see her do these wonderful sword, like impossible sword dances and moves that their skills reflect and the spell schools are, and she tells them that I wanted, essentially, that the immortals who did support the gods wanted to be able to gift some of the what they had to those who could never really reach it, not because of anything that's their fault, but literally because existence had rules that made it impossible for them. They
Yeah.
wanted to make the impossible possible for them. They
Like,
didn't. Then go ahead.
a human could spend every moment from birth and live a long and virtuous life and die at like 110 and spend every day practicing the sword and attempting to perfect its movements. And they might achieve a fraction of what an elf who decides to spend a lazy Sunday swinging the fucker around could manage. Like,
Maybe not quite that bad, but yeah, I agree. It is. It
give
is.
the elf long enough, and that's sort of the thing. The elf has that long.
And they have a. It was more than just time. It was the idea that they wanted to gift immortality and eternity to beings who didn't have it. And I'm sure that there were people on their own side who objected to that aspect of it. But I can't see that as being the only reason. There are just so many signs of so much being wrong. And perhaps, here's my speculation on that entire aspect of it. There are a few ways it could go. Excuse me. The first being that the gods themselves would have implemented some kind of tool that allowed them to force the system to give them power after the souls that were being sent to the Deadlands and who were like connected to the system, that they could eat the souls and make more things and just be lazy and do so, maybe something like that. Or the more philosophical one being one, they wanted the system, they wanted to create the system to change themselves. And they wanted them to change the universe in a way that would have broken reality and allowed in the Cthulhu creatures. It was a risk that those Cthulhu creatures could come in.
Maybe. The thing actually, if I had to take a guess at what made the system truly unpalatable to so many and started that civil war, I am willing to bet that it's an aspect that's going to have to do with the fact that it's framed as levels and a game. I think that when we do eventually find out what happened, it might be that there was something insidious to what the gods had in mind on a, it's all a fucking game, kind of level. But it's all speculation, and I am interested in finding out more details of that at some point. And, like, from there, though, you'd mentioned something about parallels with Spring Nea and someone else, and I mean, now's the time. Go into it.
Oh, well, because at the end of the book, end of the volume, there's a simple scene with the last gnome alive. It's Daenerys, and he
Chad
has his
Spaceman Gnome,
feet.
yes.
Yeah, and he has his feet dangling, neck on Eternity, and he's on the last bit of the Deadlands that Khasigna has not unraveled. And he looks Khasigna in the eye, and he tells her he loves her. And he loved her so much, and yet she could not be worthy of that love in a way. I don't. That's not exactly what he says. That's not the text, but the subtext is what I'm reading. That she wasn't worthy of it, and it broke his heart that she wasn't. And he chooses to drop into, at least I interpret it as, she never took him. Instead, he chose in his last moment to become nothing, to drop into the abyss and become nothing, rather than give himself to her. And coming from someone who genuinely says that he loved her, and the text supports this kind of deep love that you give to somebody who is your icon, your god. And then to choose to reject being a part of her and then just oblivion instead. It was. Can't describe just how it felt because it's such a funny little scene because he makes jokes and everything, but there's so much subtext to it,
Yeah.
you know?
Actually, there's subtext to a lot of the jokes that the gnomes make at the expense of the gods. And, like, there's a comment one of them made where, like, yeah, we were so excited to travel out and find out what stars were. And, you know, it was a fairly savage burn about how they were just, like, lights hung in the air, and on other planets they had actual, you know, the full fusion process of a star, and something along the lines of the gods not being able to understand it, so they just faked it. I choose to take that literally. The stars in Inworld are just floating lamps because the gods couldn't figure it out, right? And it's probably more of a metaphorical burn. Either way, though, like, the stuff that the gnome said all had that subtext of being disappointed in the deities that they had once worshipped and praised.
The as if they had a measure that as if they had something to measure up to, and the gods fell short of it. That was the crux of the subtext for that, right? They could have achieved so much. They should have been so much, and yet you couldn't get there. You're so little.
Yeah. And I think, though, that, like, I can understand why some people felt a bit frustrated at the gnomes just suddenly showing up and answering a bunch of questions, but honestly, they didn't answer that much and instead just left me wanting more, which I think is a great job for an exposition fairy to just come in and do. We had a bunch of build-up about them, especially in this book, so, like, I wasn't surprised we eventually got to see him in the afterlife. I don't know, I liked him, and I liked that they showed up, they did their thing, and then they died and left the story.
I was surprised by the note. I genuinely thought Pirate had them all eaten before the anybody got there. I honestly thought that all of the greater immortals were all eaten by the dead gods beforehand.
I was genuinely uncertain about that and thought that that was going to be an unlikely end result. In my mind, I really did sort of think to myself that if the gnomes were all dead and gone and eaten by the dead gods, we probably would have been signaled that. The fact that we heard nothing about them in the afterlife, no, something was up. I felt like that was a deliberately kind of missing story beat.
Yeah, I can see that. I the immortals in general, the way pirates set them up to kind of act as a stopgap, because what they essentially did was they pushed back again. They sacrificed themselves, right, to buy time for the living world to eventually deal with the dead gods, or at least they what we think is dead gods. I mean, at this point of the five dead gods, one is in a pit of dis death. One is locked in a box. Two are flying away into the I don't know, into space with the boy dragon and an angel. And the last, sorry, the six gods. The last two are the most fascinating because Signa is still alive and she got advice. Oh my God, that part was so good when she got advice from Tot. What was it? Wasn't Tottenvale. What is the guy's name? Oh God.
Architect man whose name I knew until you asked me.
I know it's one of those situations where I know the name, but my brain's just not connecting. It's not Tottenvale. Tottenvale was the gardener, right? So who the
Yeah.
fuck? All right, you know what? We'll figure it out later. But the architect sat there, stood in her Cassigna's face, and said,
Drevich.
"What the f Dravis? Dravis is the name," and said, "What the fuck is your problem? Your afterlife sucks." And then she listened to him. And then she undid the world, the Deadlands, and is actually gonna. The implication is actually gonna follow the plans and rebuild the Deadlands that way.
Yeah, she'll definitely take some of his advice. She did eventually eat him, so she did eventually hear something she didn't think was useful. That's probably going to be the most important bit. And pondering what cosmology this may use, the dragon is either flying off with the angel and the other two gods into the astral sea, or potentially the Phlogiston.
Okay, I need to pause. Can we pause the recording?
Yeah.
Okay, we're back, Editor-san. Starting back where we were, you were talking about a phlogiston? A phlo what?
Okay, so that's a weird D&D related deep cut that was actually itself a weird deep cut to oh God, how do you even describe this? Okay, way, way back before we understood the concept of a vacuum, people would come up with all sorts of weird ideas for what it was that, hold on, let me start from the beginning here, because in D&D, Phlogiston was in Spelljammer as a thing between the crystal spheres, so if you traveled from one, like, setting to another, you'd have to go through it, and it was highly flammable. And in the new version of Spelljammer that's coming out, that's sort of being replaced as like a version of the Astral Sea. Either way, I was making a Spelljammer D&D joke.
Okay, so it's like zones of in the astral sea or whatever the fuck it is. Okay, I get it now.
Yeah. Or it could be this crawling, screaming chaos that you get in like the Magic the Gathering
Yeah.
foundational mythology bullshit. I don't know.
Okay.
All I know is they are very conveniently out of the way, but not as permanently out of the way as the one that got chucked down the fuck you pit and the one that got put in the fuck you box. Those two ain't never coming back. The two that went off into the, metaphorical distance, I see at least Beard Man McFuckface coming back, if only because something will have to be like finished out for whatever he has
I
going
mean,
on with
Noracle
Lincoln.
found his way out of like the pit with all the Cthulhu things, so I think he can figure out how to come back to in-world. But I agree. It is temporary, and I mean that's the thrust of what happens, what is concluded from the Deadlands, is that all the effort of the dead was meant to reawaken the world and to bring back some measure of power and give them the gifts and tools that they need to oppose the gods who are going to come back inevitably, and there is no way to stop it. What they've bought is time so that people can be ready and have the chance to it, because even in the end sequence, the missing immortals that weren't shown during Eren's earlier chapters were revealed to have been flown to Rear, gone under the ground, and then attacked the sleeping form of a female demigod, as has been revealed to us.
Yep, and actually, that to me feels like a much bigger endgame threat than the dead gods have. Like, the dead gods, it's been kind of made clear, are the last vestiges of a defeated people. And they're dangerous, but there really is at this point, a limit on their ability to descend into the world and cause trouble.
With
they'll only grow stronger, but they still need to act through mortal means, like when they snag Eldavin at the end. But that demigod sleeping with divine flesh in the real world, nah, that
I
shit's
mean, there's
energy right
always the
there.
chance that Eldavin, now that he's separated from Teriok and he's taken the hand of, I don't know if he took Kawine or Kasigna's hand, but he took one of their hands.
Cosigna,
He
almost
might
certainly.
actually become the tool they use to like kill the demigod and use her flesh to revive themselves.
I don't think even with their help he could do it. Like, I think that that demigod, just by virtue of having a real physical form upon the world, is probably too strong for
Well,
that
we
to
know
happen.
for a fact that the gods died. I mean, the immortals killed them. And we know that the system itself reflects the fact that there are tools and abilities that let you kill a god. Because that's the whole point of of Kilbukich and everything that he is. He's meant to kill a god, right? To assassinate the demigod.
What really strikes me in that is the Godslayer arrow that the Thaumaturge Anne, I forget
Oh
her
my god,
name, is
yeah.
putting together. But yeah, no, it's out there. Yeah. I'm just not 100% certain that in the context of what they're capable of, that it's
Okay.
doable.
For now, I will agree with you because you're right. From this perspective, it doesn't look like the gods could be an immediate threat, and they're not supposed to be. But the demigod definitely seems like a larger threat, certainly if the demigod wakes up. But, volume 8.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or.
I was
Oh,
gonna say
sorry.
volume 8 ends on this note of peace? Question mark? That's literally how I felt like it was peace question mark. The conflicts that were brewing all throughout the last 7-ish volumes have played out more or less. Technically there's still active war, but a lot of people are like fucked up. There's a lot of powerful beings in play now that weren't before. And you get to this point where the world is like, okay, we need to chill and assess because clearly some massive thing happened and we've been warned about it, and let's just take a breath, right?
Yeah, so actually, if I had to talk about the newt, right, in the context of what you just said, because I felt like that big conflict and all the battle and war that was joining at the
Yeah.
end there, it felt to me almost like this World War I-esque situation where everybody feels like the fight is inevitable. The Civil War with the Knolls was at that point genuinely inevitable, and the Drakes feel pulled in, all for various reasons, because they're either about to attack other Drakes to stop that fight, or the Drakes are about to attack the Knolls because they know they've been caught with their hand in the magical suppression gem cookie jar, and they have to attack now before it's over. And I felt like everybody was being dragged into this large-scale race war slash dual civil war that nobody really wanted, but everybody felt like they had to. And then Fedoheb rolls in, kicks over the sandcastle, sends everyone home, and like peace question mark is so perfect of a way to describe that. Like the inevitable flow towards war has been halted. That's technically peace, but
Is
like
it?
it could start back up again just as easily if people continue
And
to
the
make those same
consequences of the
mistakes.
war and what Kirshkara and the two other the ancient shaman who spoke in a language that's not English,
Yep.
their revelations about there being gnolls in the sky and places in the sky, and then the creation of the changing of the entire geography to create all of this new land that people are clearly going to fight over is it there's so much potential conflict still in the story, but what I found from it, I still talk about it in and we talked about it in the Israel chapter. I dislike the fact that the Drakes got away with it as much as they did. I dislike the fact that it feels like the end of this happened and and it got a little reset until, or at least I felt like that, until the very last chapter, the epilogue. That's when things changed for me, because that's when it was revealed that Erin Solstice, one, is alive, and two, she got quest skills. And
Oh yeah, that was so cool. But before we get to that, there was I wanted to talk a bit more about the finale leading up to
but
it.
I'm just saying, I felt all of that, and I still feel a little bit of anger until we got to the epilogue. And that's where I landed. Go ahead.
Gotcha. Oh, I just had been thinking about a lot of it was just big blowout fun times, right? And I've been kind of talking about the Newt, but we haven't dug into the Newt in the same way we have the other arcs because I feel like, despite there being a lot of chapters set in the Newt plot didn't really start until the end and didn't really have much going for it until
And
specifically
that
the
was
finale.
because. Oh, go
Like
ahead.
it was. Oh, just say well.
Hello?
Excuse me. Yeah, sorry. I was coughing. There was so much setup to do to let us know who the new characters even were going to be. And I feel like as cool as the new plot line was, and as much as I liked a lot of the characters that we got to meet in the Revelations, it was undercut really badly by its final resolution.
And I agree mostly with one caveat. There is a theory, there's a theory that I've been working on. Wait, let me start that again. I agree with one caveat. The issue is that if you frame it a little differently, if you frame it as Pirate Abba having to make up for all the time they couldn't focus on developing the characters for the Newt in Volume 8. It makes sense why the Newt feels like a lot of hullabaloo for nothing. Because what should have happened was that the Newt's characters would have been developed across volume 5, 6, and 7, and we would have gotten perspectives, and those perspectives would have helped us to know the characters that we're dealing with. Because, to be honest, there are some characters that are used in the Newt's final conflict that were well developed. The classical example for me being Bellavere. This, I
Oh,
mean,
yeah.
you see her move through the Newt plot line, and you are. I genuinely had a butt clenching, I'm gonna piss myself fear moment whenever Bellavere shows up, because there nothing good ever happens from Bellavere showing up. And
No, it's because Bella's awful. She's evil. I still can't believe people used to defend her.
Honestly, I know exactly. She's not evil. She's just so.
No,
No,
she is
she's
so
like a
evil.
void. That's how I think of her. Like a void. There's no evil or
No,
good. She's just a void that will suck everything in and destroy you if you let yourself be sucked in.
here's the thing, right? That was Bella at her most ethereal and detached. That was the best Bella got. The more her personality has returned as she's begun to come back to herself after the haze of immortality, the more we're seeing that was an improvement over what a
Okay, you
rancid
know what?
.
I might agree with you. But the point being, Bellavere has had that level of development that we were looking for from characters like
Yeah.
the shaman of the Garmash tribe and the Plains Eyes, etc., etc. And we could talk about all of them in some various fashions, but the go ahead.
And I would say I liked all of them though, Oshi. I do think they were well developed. I think that the Newt largely did what I wanted it to and fell nicely into place in the plot. I just specifically think that the ending with the daemon was
Oh, you're talking
fucked
about
up.
the moment when you had the Arbiter Queen just saying to cut the ties and free the daemon?
And well, yeah, and here's the thing. I thought that that specifically was this really cool moment of Jacena beginning to understand and grasp what it is to be named as an arbiter and a royalty under the system and to pass judgment and make these decisions. That I wouldn't change. But instead, I would have had her look to the gnolls and ask the gnolls to pass judgment on this horrific thing built of their people and the suffering of their past. I think that, like, considering the way that that started, her looking to different gnoll chieftains and demanding that they pass judgment instead of it having be a bunch of rulers from Shandrar
I
would have been
believe
better.
that I don't recall there being only the rulers being asked. I recall that it was that the chieftains were also asked and that they also passed judgment.
I thought it was only the Shandrar people. I'll admit, there's a lot of words in this fucking finale. I could have missed something,
I think I distinctly
but
remember this because I had that same issue. And then someone pointed it out to me, that fact that the chieftains were involved in the decision making before she passed judgment. She did not borrow just the authority of the various kings and queens. She borrowed the authority of all the leadership of the Gnolls who truly wanted to pass judgment on this creature.
if that's true, then I will probably retract most of my complaints then, and just say that I really
I
liked the
will
loot.
go ahead.
Although, looking past like specifically the gnolls part in the newt, though, unexpectedly, actually, just the best part of that whole plot line was Aaron's body getting taken for a joyride by an angry old gay drake so that he could go punch a bunch of other drakes and stop
And it
being
didn't
so
work.
fucking stupid. No, it didn't work, but specifically when he uses his skill to summon the best of the
Oh my
best,
God,
he gets
okay.
Antinium. So he says, fuck it, and then he uses his skill to summon the people from his army who will hold the line and stand against anything and be the best, and then he gets Antinium again, and then he looks and goes, is it something wrong with the children? No, it must be
Okay.
me.
All I can say is the entire section where Ceres appears and in Endless Gore was so epic. The moment when he actually flies above Lascaur and the entirety of that city hears his blessing for them, or his sort of hope for them before he passes on. We've seen so much of the Deadlands be this depressing thing where all these beings are dying and they're passing away and they're leaving their last wishes to Eren. Ceres is the one person who gets to actually leave a legacy that we see. I mean, yeah, we know the ghosts come through, they all leave their shit around, but they're doing it for a purpose. Here, Ceres, because we nicknamed the combined being Saren, actually gets to tell the city that he loves, "You're doing a good job. You are becoming what I wish you were. Keep doing it. Be better. Thrive." And then he leaves. I love that sequence
Yeah.
so much.
It was so good, and I don't know, the Antinium, we've talked a lot about how great they are. They mean a lot to me as characters. Their part in the finale there was great, but you know what
What?
I wasn't expecting? That to like loop back around and then take a left turn into the Beriad name, causing Venaz to realize that Calruz is too genuinely honorable for something not to be up, and that to affect his decision so heavily, as we've seen, he's already kind of made up his mind just from that alone. And that whole plot line is now going to be totally different than I thought it was going to be, just because of these random unconnected parts slotted together so perfectly. It's one of my favorite, like, pirate writing moments. Also, the Antinium made me
I
fucking cry.
totally wept at the Beriad standing before the tide, ready to die with the Crimson Soldier in Venaz, and that moment when Bird enacted the Unitasis Network and connected all of the Hundred with the Queens. There's a couple of things from that moment that just like fucked me up so much because one, Crimson War, on a practical side, one Crimson Warrior is now connected to the Queens, and they can see what an actually effective soldier can do. Like, actually, with the ability and skills and things. And the connecting to the Beriad also means that they see what trained Antinium with, like, practical skills and an understanding of how to fight can do versus the kind of shit that they've been
And
thrown.
it lets them
What?
share skills. And it lets
Yeah,
them share
exactly.
skills.
And I know Bird surprised everyone with his telepathy shit, but come on.
And it's not even just skills in like the capital S sense. They just were like, well, we're connected to Bird. We understand basics of aiming and how to properly pull and shoot our bows with that level of masterful expertise. And everybody is sharing and becoming the greater sum of their parts, but yet they're still genuinely individuals as into a whole.
Which is
And I
what the
also.
Antinium were meant to be.
Yeah. And I just really appreciate how it took exactly 5 milliseconds after he did this for Zern to yeet full speed Kissimver and Wurmver just out to the battlefield. She wasted
Wait, wait,
no
no,
time.
no, no. That happened before this, didn't it?
No, that happened. No, the moment the Unistasis network comes through and that happens, Zern yeeted them out
I
there.
missed that. I thought the sequence was they arrived, then the network occurs.
No, the network occurs, Zern realizes it, and immediately just sends those two fuckers out there. A part of me assumes specifically to make sure that, like, Bird and whatever effect was doing this left, but also because, I don't know, for like all of her own individual weirdness, Zern kind of gets
She
it.
does. She is the best of the Antinium leaders. Not necessarily rulers, but as a leader, she is the person that knows how to do. She is the moment. She is the best.
Yeah, and talking about random unconnected things causing stuff that I really desperately needed in life to loop back together and interlink, we got like the Bash Bros of Kissimver and Relk going at it on a big battlefield, just, punking bitches and having
Honestly,
a good time.
the fact that that moment when what was his name? Spear Master something or other? Spear Lulv, right, Lulv,
Lurf.
was holding on to Mercia and he was surrounded by Kissimver, Relk. Who else was the other people that was surrounded? I don't even remember, but it doesn't matter. Like six people got dropper. And he looks at them and just says like all right, I'm out. Bye. And these guys were all fighting like 5 seconds ago. The second he appears with her, and it was great. I just love some of the flourishes the pirate put in.
Oh yeah. Actually, hell, just like sorry, actually, hell, just like that moment when Relk gets into a Spear Master duel and everything is tense and cool and it's about to go all like crazy Hong Kong spear stabby action theater, and then Relk drops his spear and says, "Eh, you're better with a spear than me. I'm just gonna punch you in the face. It's brawling time.
I
Come on, buddy,
mean
let's rest."
that's so Relk, and he's all it's like, how do I say this? It's Relk's brilliance. He understands how to beat people who are better than him. That's what makes him such a dangerous. That's why he was a quote unquote officer killer. It wasn't just that he was skilled with the spear, it's that he understood what the difference in level was and how to find the weakness in the person. She changes the battlefield to accommodate it from an intellectual point of view. From a non-intellectual, purely emotional point of
Yeah.
view, that fucker deserved a punch in the goddamn face, and I'm so happy he got one.
Oh, yeah, no, fuck that guy. Especially after that guy beat up Relk's daughter, like, that was 100% pure
There
catharsis.
is a lot to like unpack when it comes to the battle itself. I mean, Bellavere's sequences were just she banished the Weatherfur chieftain to the buried city that is now revealed to have been the original kingdom of the Gnolls capital, where there is like this all these fuck, what are they called? Rashgar, for where all the
Rakshgar.
Rashgar are. It's from that moment to when she just like indiscriminately killed a bunch of people to the moment when the coven of greater witches like appeared in the body, in the revenant bodies that they were granted, and then went like smushed her and said, "Bitch, calm down. We're not gonna punish you. We know we can't kill you. Why would we ever do that?" So they punish her by making her do something which we don't know about. And whatever she's doing, she is pissed.
I have heard a few theories on it, but this one incidentally comes from Hicks, so I'll give him credit here. I don't know if I entirely buy it, but it might just be it. The witch, the theory is the witches realize that Bella is truly, properly, gaining of
No.
immortality,
Wait,
so
wait,
they
wait.
want her
No,
to.
because in this sequence, when she sees Wurmver, she says, "You have the secret of immortality. Tell me about it. What is it? I must know." It.
Well, okay. Hold on. There's two separate things here. I think it's just because like Wurmver is fucking weird and has never died, but she has cracked the code of living for longer than just about anything else we've seen that wasn't born immortal, and is immune to a whole bunch of fucking shit that isn't angry fire from dragons or angry fire from knights that have a grudge. Like she has cracked the code for good enough immortality for these purposes, then, if we really must
We
draw a
must.
distinction here. And okay, fine, if we must. And they have said to Bella, listen, we need information to be passed along if this all of this doesn't work out. So we call upon you to do your duty as our coven sister and sit at the bottom of the ocean for a few thousand years and then pop up and see if the god problem is still a
Holy
problem.
fuck, that. Holy. Oh my God, that might actually be. Oh my God, that. Might actually be true. Although, to be fair, she did waste a lot of her resources. She might la last a few thousand years if you have to stick in the bottom of the sea. So maybe.
I think maybe she could, if it was just a matter of her just like taking a nap and avoiding being
I
eaten by
mean.
krakens. But like I said, I'm not personally convinced of this,
Okay.
but it was a good
It
theory.
might just be a few hundred years instead of a few thousand. But I would agree that, that's plausible. My thing is, the reason I mentioned the immortality bit, because it reveals something about Bellavere to me. The theory was that, from the person that I picked this up from, whose name, I'm sorry, I can't remember right now, was that because she said that, she's never achieved true immortality. What she instead did was freeze her mortal form inside of something and effectively live on borrowed time. Eating the rest of the world's time, taking away the threads of their life, and using her craft to create a second form outside of her mortal one, and living that thread, projecting herself out from wherever she's frozen herself into, and that's how she's able to achieve. But she's never actually become immortal. And meanwhile, the Centinium have true immortality because they can come back, they can continue to exist. They can keep going so long as there's someone to bring them back.
Maybe. I my issue with that theory is the way that it would have interacted with Nier's, because when Nier's used his magic doesn't exist here for a minute skill, that was her real body that the eye got stabbed out of. So it can't be elsewhere. I do agree that she is probably living off of some kind of borrowed time
You have to
situation.
imagine whatever ceremony she did took into consideration the idea that the form, the borrowed time she's living in, would it be in places where there was no magic. Also, I think the skill is more limited than he thinks it is, because it isn't so much that it eliminates magic's existence, because if it did that, the there are several species that are dependent on magic that would see, including himself. That would cease to exist. It suppresses the effects, doesn't remove them.
I disagree. I'll just go ahead and say that at the very least, assuming that magic is required for Freylurines to exist makes perfect sense from us, people who live in the real world without magic. But I mean, it's funky magic world, like fantasy land. For all we know, these Freylurines can just exist at a few inches tall and just be fine. They don't need magic, they just need an entirely separate concept of biology and cells that are just built
Okay,
differently.
but I'm gonna disagree because it does not make sense, their existence, based on what we know about, like, just the amount of matter it takes for a single human being to just exist as an organism. Anyway,
Oh, I agree.
but let's, I think that's it. Can we talk about the end chapter now before we got like 20 minutes left?
I think now is time for us to finally dig into it. Well, hold on, there's
All right.
one last thing. I don't know if we ever got to see any levels or anything picked up from or by Pisces, but by God, that man put his sword through Tamaroth and saved the entire
Everybody says
universe
that.
in like one fell stab. I know, I want to know if the system gave him a big
Okay,
boost
look.
or not,
Everybody
okay?
says that because they want it to be real that Tamaroth is gone. But Tamaroth is tiny. Like, he took over a fucking. He's a god. Hot. Okay, I'm gonna start this guy. Tamaroth is a god. Gods create avatars. They do it all the fucking time. He created a tiny avatar inside of a tiny, like, fucking skull being. That was really powerful and could fuck with a bunch of people. And Pisces snapped its neck and got rid of it. And that's what Pisces destroyed, the avatar. He did not defeat Tamaroth, the god!
Okay, so hold on. Two things. One, I never said that he killed Tamaroth. We know Tamaroth was still alive at that point because he needed to still be dragged off by the dragon. Two, I think the Avatar thing gets complicated because, as near as I can understand the way that that situation worked out, Tamaroth had fully and bodily entered into the real world with that skeleton as his form, which was going to be exceptionally dangerous and allow him to wield power on the plane, similar to how it would have been incredibly dangerous if one of them had gotten Eren's body, which they were fighting real hard over for a real reason. So, yes, he kind of did defeat Tamaroth, if only because Tamaroth's form was a unique scissors to Pisces rock, and Pisces got him by surprise. And I know what the challenge rating is, even on an avatar. The system better be giving
I'm
Pisces
just saying
experience
that
already.
Avatar was a co direct consequence of the ritual done by Kelt. It wasn't something that the gods planned around, so their full potential is not there. The full strength is not there. They're certainly stronger than your average skeleton and certainly have more to them, but I just if it happens, if Pisces gets some kind of god killer skill, I will be super disappointed.
I don't specifically want him to get a God's Killer skill. I just think it'd be funny if he's like cherry tap skeleton god and accidentally picks up
Fine,
15 levels,
whatever.
right? Like, there's a lot of humor in that. And I feel like you are really aggressive on this idea that that couldn't have been that all that
The
dangerous or all that
danger.
much of a risk, and that Tamaroth wasn't gonna do all that much. When, like, the narrative treated him as getting that physical form as being potentially ruinous before Pisces
Okay,
got to him.
hang on, hang on.
Anyways, we.
I don't disagree with that it could have been potentially ruinous. I just disagree that the system will treat it that as a cha as a really high challenge rating. We've seen it before because it's not it's never it's about pushing yourself, right? And Pisces doesn't have to push himself. He just has that unique skill that allows him to stop this being because of a unique set of circumstances.
It can.
Why would he suddenly gain a lot from the system after applying the kind of skills that he's already good at to do a task that he's already supposed to be able to do?
Because the system rewards several things. It rewards doing new things that have an inherently high challenge in and of themselves. It rewards situations and stressors that are unique to the person, and I think that in this context, like, oh yeah, so that big dragon you defeated was probably actually just like a hatchling that had only been around for like 5 months. Probably still counts as slaying a dragon for system purposes and a system-related, like, unique challenge level boost and
All
potentially
right.
a skill. I don't know if it's gonna care that much. If anything, this might be an issue of there's only laws for attempted deicide because nobody put in a law for deicide and the system doesn't know what to do with him, like it didn't know what to do
Right.
with
And
Eren.
Eren just, it was sad for a moment to see how many classes she could have gotten, including the dragon friend one, which was crazy. Level 40 fucking one as a dragon friend. That's insanity. And
Oh,
then
yeah.
you realize as she loses them that there's a chance that Erin will lose all of her memories from the Deadlands. And then also the hint, nay, almost complete confirmation that Neravia has survived and is still around because you get a Neravia's
Yeah.
servant fucking class. Bitch has a fucking class named Neravia's Servant. Wow.
Well, when you're known as the Tyrant, you probably have several things that qualify as a class attached to you, and
The
servants is probably one
sequence
of the
with Neravia, by the
ones.
way, where she slapped the fucking Zeresian dude and it slapped his entire fucking family was golden.
Oh, yeah, and then a contract pops up that says if he slaps her
Oh,
back, it's
not that
war.
it's war, that everybody is bound by her order to go to war with them. Like, it's
Oh, yeah.
insanity what she can do. How the fuck? And you know what I speculated when that showed up was that she's a lawyer or an accountant, and that's how she got her. And that's how she combined the two classes to become the tyrant.
Could be. I did appreciate then that the perfectly normal person with no class levels walked over and
Oh
slapped
yeah,
her in the
Asael
face.
is brilliant, and the nice revelation that there's always one person who doesn't have levels in Xeras's command structure. People know about not leveling and about it, their effects on like tyrants and abilities, so it makes sense.
Yeah. And like the final chapter and the leveling thing, I really thought that Pirate was gonna say to us, "Well, ha 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 ha, we have had this brilliant series of chapters and this big fight scene and this big finale, and then Erin wakes up and barely gets any new classes out of it, and she's forgotten most of everything." And I'm thinking to myself, okay, so the first bit of the next book is going to be unlocking these memories and finding some way to communicate. And then Erin just says no. Erin just says, fuck you. I have, in fact, been through way too goddamn much, and I am not forgetting any of it. And I'm just going to sit here trying to remember it until either my head breaks open or you budge. And then the grand design just says, okay, fuck it, and pushes the, file folder for quests out of the fucking trash file and into the fucking completed
I
files.
found that a brilliant, and this is a little bit of back page stuff for you guys. Assistant revealed it. Essentially, Pirate, the as far as I can understand, that function existed, but was never active, and now because of Erin is active, meaning the function was already part of the grand design, so it's nothing new, but it was just never active. And that's in the entire existence of the system itself. Hundreds of thousands of years.
And what we were t yeah, and what we were told about the grand design never being finished, that actually makes a lot more sense than it would have before we learned that
Right.
information. It makes me wonder if Aaron's not going to have to deal with, I was about to say metaphorical bugs in the code, but there could be literal bugs in the code. Like an actual giant, like carnivorous beetle could wind up popping out of a wall and trying to eat her because a skill goes
The
wrong one of
other
those fun
aspect of it
days.
is that because it's a new slash old function, it might be on its basest, like the system itself works by like a pseudo AI does in our real world, right? It has a set of criteria. It tries to match the criteria and grant specific abilities, and then it looks for any new functions or abilities achieved by the users, quote unquote, and then copies them over so it can be used by other users. That's very much the simplest way. Now, how the hell do you apply something like that to something as flexible as the quest system?
I mean, so if you think of it like the way a neural network might learn, it would probably do so by looking at every.
You okay?
It might do that by looking at every quest that has ever been given out in the history
Now,
of
here's the
ever,
thing.
and working out what rewards it saw people giving. And then attempting to figure out what fair amounts are. The thing is, we don't know what the system's ability to create rewards out of thin air would
More than
actually
that,
be.
what are the
So.
parameters for what defines a skill? If this particular function has always existed, then that means that, and it's been inactive this whole time, maybe the system hasn't been tracking those particular things. So it can't go back, and we've just been demonstrated by the fact that the system can't give Erin classes because the Deadlands no longer have the beings that would qualify her for the class. What if, because the system doesn't have enough
Well,
information, there are severe limitations to how the quest system can function, and Erin is who writes the code, so to speak, for the system to heuristically learn how to do this? Why do I use heuristically? I don't even know what that means.
okay, so two thoughts. One, I think that the Aaron not getting class levels thing isn't as deeply terrifying in its implications as it initially seemed. I think that like the thing about how some of the classes like Slaver or Naravi whatever that the system tried to give her were related to people who were trying to like force a
Yes.
class onto her. I think it's because those people trying to force the class had ceased to exist, not because the system had forgotten what Dragonfriend
No,
was.
because there's a div
Ex Well, except for
No,
maybe
no,
for the
no.
Dragonfriend one, because if the dragons don't exist
No,
anymore,
no.
then
He
how can
here's
you
the
be their
thing.
friend? But.
The classes were clearly divided in the progression that they were given. Pirate starts with classes like Queen of the Dead kind of deal. And that requires the existence of Kelta to grant her the class. Now, Kelta doesn't exist, so she can't get the class. And we go through a list of personally granted classes, apprentice, etc., etc., and rebel, but all of them have the qualifier that someone else has to trigger the development of the class. And the system can't find the people that would grant her the class, so they can't. And then we get to Naravia, Servant, and Slaver, and those were particular classes that did not require the existence of an individual, but rather the existence of the class itself. So Naravia was smart enough to do what the witches did, which is to teach her enough or show her enough to qualify her for the class so she could.
Well, no, because remember,
I know,
Naravia
but
lived.
I'm saying that that's what Naravia did to her. I think Naravia is where she got the slaver class ask. And,
Maybe. I don't know if I entirely agree with that. But the second thing I was going to say is, so at the very least, the system is capable of discerning different levels of quest, because, the way that it was labeled out
basic.
had like, you know,
No.
grand, basic,
It starts here.
epic, and
So
so on.
basic, rare, epic, and then legendary, then mythic. Or was it mythic, then legendary? I had a joke about that one.
I don't remember the specifics. I think the important thing, though, is just that the system is capable of recognizing and
The
labeling
reason
those
I'm
kinds of things
mentioning
out,
the
right? And I think that it probably has built-in baseline minimums for different kinds of quests like that, and probably had a decent amount written in for parameters for that kind of thing, just as like the design as intended, and that it probably has enough to work off of to at least like get the ball rolling while it then starts giving access to quest giving to more people to start gathering
I
more
can
information.
agree with that. I was going to say the reason I'm mentioning the different ranks is because Pyre copied the WoW ranks. The World of Warcraft legendary items and quest ranks, all of the, it's literally the same progression that World of Warcraft uses. I don't think most people notice it, but I noticed it. So, because I played WoW for so long. It's the same thing for like Diablo, etc. Same, it's supposed to be basic. Or white, then you have the blue quest, then you have the orange quest, the purple quest, the orange quest, and then the mythic ones are like light teal and whatnot. But
Yeah, the different like levels and kinds of
yeah.
item. I know what you mean. I just hadn't realized it was copied
It, I
over
don't think Pyre
exactly.
meant to copy it over exactly. They might have even flipped one or two of them, like legendary and mythic, but it's there. I mean, it's such a common thematic thing, and it just I noticed it right away. I don't think they meant to do it, but it's so. I mean, it is what it is.
If Pirate meant to do it, then they clearly would then have also made every quest type its own color that would have been suspiciously like every single RPG uses, which starts at white, goes to blue, then purple, then red, and then orange, or orange and then red. Every
Yeah,
last
and I
one
think
of
it
them.
actually is different. I think it's like I see it now, like basic, rare, heroic, mythical, and then legendary. So, I was wrong, but the quest progression in my head when it first came out made so much sense. It fit the traditional stuff. But that's where the chapter ends, on the last words of Kawe to tell Pisces, and that Eren remembered, and that was the end of the volume. I thought it was a good volume.
Yeah. So did I. I really liked it. I thought that it delved into a lot of cool things all over the place. I am looking forward to what I think Pirate has said is going to be a bit more of a sedate slice of
Well,
lifey type book where everybody reconnects and pulls back together after being scattered to the
I wanted to
metaphorical
talk about, like
winds.
we always do for chapter, for our usual stuff, we talk about the pirates. Author note, and this one was a doozy. They wrote like half the chapter was essentially their pirate their note. They talked about how difficult it was to write this. It's like they were so exhausted at the end of this volume that they could not watch or consume or look at anything because they were so tired. And Terry Pratchett, and they quoted Terry Pratchett, who once said, once claimed to love the act of writing as much as the finished work itself. And apparently Pirate loves the act of writing because they write so much, and it was breaking them a little bit. They promised to take it easier, to pace themselves differently. I think Pirate Abba has reached the end of the pushing phase, where they've reached the end of what they're capable of, physically, mentally, and they figured it out. They've reached their limit. And I'm very happy they have, because it means that they can finally start exploring how they write in a different way. Rather than pushing for their limits, they can look for complexity in their writing in a different way.
Yeah, or just, there was a YouTube video both you and I were talking about by Sarah Zed, about like the way binge watching versus pacing stuff out leads to different kinds of ways people consume and talk about things. And I think that smaller chapters with stuff spread out a bit more is going to make it easier to connect with characters and plot lines to a degree. If
Yeah,
that
it
makes
does.
any sense.
What I was thinking of when you said that was that there is a what allowed us to develop the community that we have to for me to get into this, and was the week-to-week chapters in volume 6 and 7. And they were big, but they weren't like this. They were cliffhangery in their own way. They brought that connection that everybody looks for. I think Sarah talked a lot about comparing the experience of Who Shot JR from Dynasty in the 80s versus the drops that we get from like Squid Game, where it's just great for a
Oh,
moment and it's
yeah.
a great for that moment, but it's only a moment and passes away. Whereas with Who Shot JR, it was like a year's worth of time. People had to think about it, talk about it, share it, discuss it, dissect it, sell products.
Yeah, and even though it was
And
utterly.
even though it was shit at the end, when we found out, we still loved it. Like, I wasn't alive then, but the point being, I think our Who Shot JR,
People talk
yeah, I
about it
think
to this
our what would
day.
our Who Shot JR moment be for millennials? Lost?
I actually am gonna go ahead and say that our Who Shot JR moment was Snape killing
Oh,
Dumbledore.
maybe. Yeah, Snape killing Dumbledore, or in my case, if I want to talk about TV, it would have to be the Buffy. No, what is Buffy season? Where she dies? Or maybe.
Maybe So I think part of this to consider is just like a level of cultural phenomena that despite Buffy being popular and liked, I don't think it had that same level of mainstream. Everybody is
That's
talking
true.
about
That's true.
this. Like I literally went into a bookstore in between that sixth and seventh Harry Potter book, and like there were people that were actually getting published as authors by writing books breaking down on whether or not Snape was going to turn out to
That
be a
is
villain in
true.
the end. People talked about
There
it.
isn't as much like that nowadays, just because everything is so scattered. But to be honest, I think that's a consequence of the media landscape changing, just like Sarah talked about. And part of it is reflected in the way Pirate ABBA wrote and the way serialized fiction has been coming back as such a strong force in through Royal Roads, through lit RPGs, through Gamelit in general, through the serialized audio novels that have been coming out. You see people looking for those connective social tissues, the social like aspects that allow us to connect, and the pandemic kind of emphasized that even more. We need those reasons to talk to each other.
The Marvel movies have really managed to capture and sort of glom onto that zeitgeist as well. So has stuff like Stranger Things, which lets like some genuine time go between its many new seasons and puts a lot of like thought into the transition from season to season. And I don't know, you could just feel a difference between something like Peacemaker, where it's coming out week to week and you're getting conversation out of it, and something that comes out all at once and you try and get people to talk about it and people do for a minute and then it's over.
And that's where we're at. I believe that's our philosophical discussion on volume 8. I suppose we spent so much time talking about everything else. Anyway, thanks for listening, everybody. This is concluding our three-part series on volume 8. We're back to our normally scheduled recap in volume 2 next week. See you then. Say
See you then. Goodbye,
bye.
everybody.
You've been listening to No Killing Goblins. The music on No Killing Goblins was composed by System Glitch. They can be found at youtube.com/systemglitch. You can get in touch with us via our Twitter at NoKillingGoblin or email us at NoKillingGoblins with an S at gmail.com.
Edited by Liquid Ender.